Psy 2019. So review courses are courses that are somehow more advanced and should bring you guys closer to topics of current research. And in this course, we will present a number of topics that are, some are traditional, but some are very modern. And even the traditional ones, we come from a more modern point of view. We will use a bunch of tools coming from integrable systems, quantum information theory, quantum field theory, and other things. Some of these tools will be pretty technical. Some others will be more conceptual. And in modern research in condensed matter theory, the traditional distinctions between, you know, what is condensed matter theory, what is high energy, and what is information, and basically any other topic in theoretical physics, these traditional boundaries get a bit muddled, okay? So we will be talking of many things, and we will be talking about critical phases. Integrable systems, topological, phases of the matter, out of equilibrium, systems, scrambling, and black holes. Wow, black holes in a condensed matter theory course, and many other things. And the reason is that, and this is the beauty of theoretical physics, that some topics actually are ubiquitous, and some things that can describe a material in other situations can describe maybe a black hole or some of the physics of the black hole. So these are some of the topics that we will look at, but we will also learn some tools, okay? And these tools are of fundamental importance for a theoretical physicist, no matter whether you want to be a condensed matter theorist or not. Okay, so if you have these tricks in your toolbox, you will be, you know, they will be part of your research, and we will learn techniques like exact solution, of spin chains, or theorem about clustering of correlations, or the so-called Lieb-Robinson bounds. Or mathematical techniques like taking averages on the Hilbert space. So these techniques are very interesting, they're very instructive, and there is a whole bunch of problems that are only waiting to be examined from other points of view, from other angles, using these techniques. So that's why they're very useful. Okay. So the main topic of this course is to talk about, now there is this fancy word, quantum matter. Okay, so we need the word matter, you know, to make justice of the fact that this is a condensed matter course. Okay, so what do we mean by quantum matter? Okay, so many of the things that people mean are topics like this. Okay, and what do all these topics have in common? So what they have in common is that we are talking about some emergent macroscopic behavior of a system that has many bodies, in which the quantum features are essential. Okay? So there are many emergent behaviors, and general condensed matter theory is all concerned with this fact. So we're interested in those properties of a many-body system that only happen when the system goes to the thermodynamic limit. So they are not properties of the single constituents themselves. So do you know it? The most paradigmatic example of this? What is it? So the superconductor is a great example. A very general example is symmetry breaking. Okay? Symmetry breaking is something that happens in the thermodynamic limit. It's not the property of a system of few particles. Definitely, symmetry breaking is involved in superconductivity, and the superconductor is also an example of quantum matter because not only it features some emergent behavior, but in superconductivity, the fact that you have macroscopic quantum fluctuations is of fundamental importance. Okay. So this is our object of interest, and most of the course will be devoted to understanding the notion of quantum phase. So, whereas quantum matter is any many-body system with some emergent behavior in which quantum features are important, a quantum phase is a particular kind of these systems. For instance, a system featuring topological order, okay? Or a system featuring spontaneous magnetization. They constitute quantum phases of matter. So notice that in saying that a quantum phase is a particular kind of quantum matter, I am somehow using an oxymoron, right? Because I'm saying it's a particular, so it's something particular, and then I say kind, and kind is a class, okay? So it's something general. And this is, in fact, exactly what we need to understand about quantum phases, that they are classes of equivalence in which systems that are different, but they belong to the same quantum phase. So they have something in common, so that we say, oh, they belong to the same quantum phase. However, not all the quantum phases are the same quantum phases. We have different quantum phases, okay? So most of the goals of this topic is to understand what are the characteristics of a quantum many-body system that define a quantum phase. What makes us say that this Hamiltonian and this Hamiltonian describe two different quantum systems, quantum phases, sorry, whereas these two other different Hamiltonians are in the same quantum phase. Okay, so this will be a long journey. And to some extent, what people mean by this is still under investigation, because pretty much the way you define this notion leads you towards certain directions of research. So we will see many ways of understanding this sentence. A lot of emphasis will be given to the concepts of quantum correlations. I will use this word in the most general sense. So I will mean by this both correlations that only happen in quantum systems, like entanglement, or classical correlations in the sense that they do not violate, say, Bell inequalities. However, these correlations are there because the total, maybe, let's say, correlations between part A and part B of the system. But maybe, although the correlation between A and B is classical, it is there because the macroscopic full state is in a coherent quantum superposition. So also the origin of these classical correlations in the end comes from some quantum coherence. Very good. So this is more or less an outline of what we will be talking about. So let us start. Okay? So the first notion that we want to introduce is that of local quantum systems. The reason why we want to introduce this notion is because since we are interested to the emergent behavior of a system that is many-body, so we are interested in understanding not what happens to a single particle, but to the system as a whole, so we are interested in something global. Okay? Now, the notion of something global only makes sense if you start from a system that is local. Everything is very well defined local. And then you can say, oh, okay, then there is something that emerges from it that is non-local. Okay, so we need first to understand what is a local quantum system. And we start in this way. So first of all, a quantum system is not just a Hamiltonian, but as you know, it's both a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian. And usually, this distinction, the fact that we also need to define the Hilbert space is overlooked because you give the Hamiltonian, it's pretty obvious on which Hilbert space it acts, it's defined. But now I want to give you a very simple example in which we see that the structure the Hilbert space has also has an impact on what type of physics the Hamiltonian is describing, even if you have the same Hamiltonian. So imagine, for instance, that you have the Hilbert space of a particle on a line. Okay, so your Hilbert space is just the set of cats labeled by x. So x is the position of the particle on the line. So this is some real number. And now consider a Hamiltonian that says, okay, this particle is subject to a periodic potential. Of this type. So you see that the energy of this particle at this point and the energy of the particle at this other point is the same. they have the same energy in two different points. In other words, translating the particle from x to x plus a is what? What is it, this translation? So I translate the particle from x to x plus a. This operator, what is it?
Symmetry.
It's a symmetry, very good. This is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Okay, and so we talk about symmetries and things like that. But now consider a different Hilbert space, a particle on a circle of circumference A. Okay? So I'm describing a particle that can be on a circle. And now the Hilbert space is not this, it's different, right? Because the only way we can label these cats is x mod a. In other words, the cat x and the cat x plus a just identify the same quantum state. See, the Hilbert space itself is compactified. Well, now I consider the same Hamiltonian. Okay? So notice that the Hamiltonian for this Hilbert space must be periodic, right? Because otherwise, if this was not periodic, then we would say that when the particle is here, it has some energy. And then when the particle is here, it has a different energy. It just doesn't make sense. It's a constraint. So now, for the same Hamiltonian, this transformation, do you think it's a symmetry? Mathematically, it's the same thing, right? You still have the same property that this operator commutes with the Hamiltonian, but it is not a symmetry, just a constraint that has to do with the fact that this Hamiltonian must be an operator on this Hilbert space. If you had a Hamiltonian that does not commute with that operator, then if I take a state in here and I act on it with the Hamiltonian, I get out of my Hilbert space. Okay. So this is just a very simple example that shows how some of these, attentions that sometimes is just mathematical precision, but sometimes are very important. In our case, it will be very important. We will have much to say about this because we will be talking about lattice gauge theories and topological order, and they arise especially because you have structures like this. So gauge structures are something like this. They consist in the fact that you identify two states as being the same state. We will have much to say about this in the future. Okay. So, what is our local quantum system? First of all, we say that we have a local Hilbert space, say, a d-dimensional Hilbert space. So this is a finite-dimensional Hilbert space. We will be working mostly with finite-dimensional Hilbert spaces. So this is just a d-level system. So this is our localized Hilbert space. And our total Hilbert space is defined to be just the tensor product of all of them. So from now on, capital N is the number of bodies that we have in our system. So we have an N-body system. If these Hilbert spaces, so these dimensions can be different, but if they are all the same, of course, the total dimension of the Hilbert space is just d to the n, and we call it small n. Okay, so this is a local Hilbert space. At this point, we are interested in describing models in which the number of particles can be arbitrarily large, and in particular, we are interested in taking the thermodynamic limit and going to infinity. And we will see that this procedure has some very profound consequences, okay? Because somehow we need to understand what is the Hilbert space when n goes to infinity. So now, if you remember from basic courses of quantum mechanics, a Hilbert space is just, at least in finite dimensions, is a vector space with an inner product, pretty much. This is what it is. And we can say, okay, you know, if phi I is a basis vector in this Hilbert space, then I can say that this is a basis vector in this Hilbert space. And then when I take the thermodynamic limit, this object will be my basis element in the infinite tensor product Hilbert space that we have. So far, so good. Let's see, though, what happens to the inner product between two states. So this is, of course, the product of each of these guys. And now we take the limit of n going to infinity. And now we have a problem, because this product is not guaranteed to converge. In fact, it is very easy, for instance, to find examples in which this product is always zero. Becomes trivial. So we don't have a well-defined inner product. Example, imagine, for instance, that these two basis states are, one is all spins up, okay? So we are in a system where each of these local Hilbert spaces is a two-level system. So it has two states up and down, and we have many of them. And we have a global state that is all spins up. And then we only rotate very slightly of the same quantity each spin. So that for each pair, the inner product is very well defined, and it's also very close to one. So these states are not orthogonal, right? Are two states that are very similar. However, you can see that if you take the inner product of these two states, of the global state, so let me write it like this, tensor n, this is the same that I'm writing this as a bra, and the one that is slightly tilted, well, this will be equal to 1 minus epsilon to the n. And in the thermodynamic limit, this goes to zero. So we are in trouble. So we can't just define a Hilbert space in the thermodynamic limit by taking the infinite tensor product. So von Neumann came up with this solution that is the following. So imagine that I construct my Hilbert space only in this way. I start from some reference state, say all spins up, and then I put in my Hilbert space only states that can differ from this state on a finite number of spins. okay? So I will have my reference state, let me call it capital phi, that is the tensor product of all my single particle states. For instance, all spins up. And then any other basis states will be of the form the tensor product for I that belong to a set, a finite set X of indices of some psi I's, times a tensor product everywhere else. And these are the same. Okay? So you only consider basis states that are different on a finite subset. Now, what happens when you take the inner product of these two? You will have the product with all these indices in X, which is finite, of phi I, psi I, times the product on the complement of X of phi I, which you can choose to be one. And the first product is finite. Okay? So this works. Okay, so this is called von Neumann infinite tensor product. And now this thing has a very profound consequence. Because now we are forced to admit in the theory every physical operator that we have in the theory, some operator A, say, let me call it A tilde, must have this form, must be some operator A on X, tensor, the identity everywhere else. Right? Because otherwise, if I have an operator that is non-trivial, it's not the identity, on an infinite number of indices, then this operator acting on this state takes me away from my Hilbert space of states that belong to the infinite tensor product in the right way. Is this clear? So if we call the cardinality of X, let's say it's upper bounded by number capital R, we will say that a capital R local quantum system is a quantum system in which we have an Hilbert space defined in this way, and all the operators of the theory are defined, so every A must be some bounded operator on Hx. What is Hx? It's the tensor product of all my Hilbert spaces with the index belonging to X. Let me pull this up so it's more visible. When the operator A still acts on the full Hilbert space, but is non-trivial only on X. Hx is called the support of the operator Ax. Okay? This is called a quasi-local quantum algebra of observables. All the observables of our theory must be quasi-local in the sense defined. So we choose a certain number R, and we say everything in our theory must be R local, means cannot involve more than R Hilbert spaces. Okay, so you see that these considerations on the thermodynamic limit give you a constraint of locality on what a physical operator can be. You cannot have arbitrary operators on a Hilbert space. And there is more. Because the thermodynamic limit has also some bearings on energy. So imagine, for instance, that you have a system of n charges. Okay. So we have n charges subject to a Coulomb-like potential that has this form. It is A over R minus R prime to the sigma. Okay, so R prime is the location of the source charge. R is where we observe our potential. For sigma equal 1, this is Coulomb potential. This is a generic power law potential. Okay? And we ask, okay, let me distribute these charges on a sphere. What is the energy that we have? And a d-dimensional sphere, so in d dimensions, omega, so what is the of radius r? Okay, so what will be the total energy as a function of r? So you know what you have to do. You have to integrate on the whole sphere. And we will have this density. Then you have this potential to the sigma. And then you have this other density. And then here we have the measure on the d-dimensional space. OK. Like this. OK. So for the sake of simplicity, consider a uniform distribution of charges, okay, so that we don't need to get crazy to do this integral. So outside the integral, we have a rho square. And then let me rescale these quantities. So let me call r equal rx and r prime is equal ry. So if you do that, what we have here is that we are integrating on the unit sphere. And here we have rx minus ry to the sigma. Here we have dx dy. And here we have r to the 2d. Do you agree? And when I take this r out, what I get is minus sigma. Okay. Now, this is an integral of this quantity on the unit sphere. It's some number. This integral is well defined. It's some number c. So you see that all this is some constant times r to the 2d minus sigma. So the energy you see is extensive. That's OK. The bigger is a system. So if our system has a radius r that becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, our energy becomes bigger, larger and larger, and that's fine. Energy is extensive. But let's look at intensive quantities, OK? The energy density, how much energy you have per unit volume. So this is the energy within the sphere of radius, d-dimensional sphere of radius r, over the volume of the d-dimensional sphere of radius r. And this goes like r to the 2d minus sigma. And this goes like r to the d. So this is just r to the d minus sigma. And now in the familiar example of Coulomb potential, in which d is 3 and sigma is 1, you see that this quantity does diverge in the thermodynamic limit. And this is not physically possible. You cannot put an infinite amount of energy in a finite space. Okay? So you cannot have an infinite number of charges, a system with an infinite number of charges, even if they are, I'm not saying that all the charges are in a single point. They are uniformly distributed within a large sphere of radius r, but that cannot be, because that would give us a density of energy that is divergent. So now we are in a, we have a problem, right? Because this is exactly the potential that describes ordinary matter. At Coulomb potential, at low energies, matter only interacts electromagnetically, electrostatically, so to speak. So how come we can define, you know, how can we do statistical mechanics with ordinary matter if we have just proven that the energy density is divergent? Can you guess what's going on here? Why ordinary matter is in fact stable?
Maybe because the Coulomb potential is screened?
Yes. Because luckily you have positive and negative charges and they screen each other. And what happens when you screen each other? You have the so-called Debye potential that is something like a constant. And this is the Debye screening length. So that's the effective potential that you have due to screening. So you see, what this does is that this gives us a range cutoff to the interaction. Pretty much you can say, after a distance LD, they're not interacting anymore. If you put this in here and you integrate, this exponential cutoff will kill any dependence with R. I don't need to integrate up to R. I only need to integrate the energy up to a certain distance. So you see, the fact that in order to take the thermodynamic limit, we need energy density to be convergent means interactions cannot be arbitrarily long-ranged. So not only the operators must be R-local in the sense that the number of pieces in the Hilbert space on which they act must be finite, say, two-body interaction, okay? But also, these two bodies cannot be arbitrarily far apart. So we will be concerned with so-called capital R, small r, local quantum systems. Where this is a bound to the size of the Hilbert space. And this is a bound to the range of interactions. And for the sake of simplicity, we will take a sharp cutoff, not an exponential cutoff, like in this case of this potential. We will be only concerned with interactions that act up to a certain given distance r. Okay? And now you see that we need to specify how we measure this r. Okay? So what we'll do is to not imagine our quantum system in real space, but we will imagine it on a graph. Okay? So let me define, give you a few definitions of simple definitions of graph theory, this is what we will be using. They have an advantage that because we are not using other more complicated metric structures, we will see in the following that some other things that typically belong to other fields like Lorentz invariants, finite speed of light, and things like that, they actually can emerge by systems that are not born already on a manifold that is a pseudo-Riemannian manifold of things like that. Okay? So we start with just a graph. So we have a collection of Hilbert spaces, right? Because our total Hilbert space will be a collection of local Hilbert spaces in some set lambda. And all the elements of lambda, I can draw them as dots. Now, I need to define something that is called the set of edges. The set of edges is just a subset, E, of the power set of lambda. Who of you knows what is the power set of a set?
Containing all subsets?
No, the power set is the collection of the set plus all union with all its possible Cartesian products with itself. So the set of all the points in lambda, union, the set of all the pairs of points in lambda, union the set of all the triples of points in lambda, and so on and so forth. And E is a subset of the power set. For instance, a set that contains one point, two pairs of points, and one triple of points. And if I had to draw it, it could be this point, these two pairs, and this triple, this bubble. This would be my set of edges, and this is what is called a graph. So a graph is just, graph gamma is just lambda and E. A more familiar example would be a graph in which all the edges only are subsets of lambda square. So they're only pairs. Let me draw it. It would be something like this. Okay, so these are all my dots. And I take a subset of all the possible pairs. So maybe this pair, this pair, this pair. This is a graph. When your edges are only pairs of points, they're called links or bonds. Questions? So far, so good? Okay. Now, the cool thing is that on a graph, there is a natural notion of distance called graph distance that works in this way. So imagine that you have two points in your set lambda, and you want to build a path of length L between these two points. So a path of length L. Between x and y, what it will be, it is just what you imagine, is a collection of edges, of L edges, such that the first point belongs to the first edge, the last point belongs to the last edge, and all the edges in between have non-null intersection. So let me do an example. I have many points. And a path from x to y is like this. So the last edge contains y, the first edge contains x, and all the other edges have an overlap somewhere. So this is a path of length L, L just being the number of edges. Now, what do you imagine? Is there any question? What do you imagine will be the distance between x and y?
The minimum of those paths.
The minimum over all the possible paths of the L's that are associated to those paths. So this is the graph distance. So you see, in order to define graph distance, we do not need any other metric structure. This is the most elementary distance that you can imagine. The graph is such an elementary object that does not immediately have all the properties that you want from something that somehow resembles space. For instance, generally, a graph does not have a dimension. You can connect these dots in a crazy way such that there is no dimension. However, if you can define what is called the ball of radius r, which is just the set of all points starting from some specific point that are a distance r from it. And you count the number, let me call it V as volume, of points within R. So the number of points that are at distance R from a given point, if all across the graph this quantity goes like this, then I will say that this is the dimension of the graph. So not all graphs have a dimension, but some have. And it's defined in this way. So in fact, this is the most elementary notion of dimension that you can imagine. And by the way, this can be a fraction. And this is exactly what defines fractals. Fractals are graphs in which the dimension is a fractional number. It's called the Hausdorff dimension. Very good. OK, so now that we have a concept of distance on a graph, we want to say that our interactions have a finite range, small r, which means that somehow we do not want any 2 degrees of freedom that are located at Hilbert spaces that are at a distance greater than r, we don't want them to interact. Okay, so how do we do that? So we can do it in a very precise way. We define what is called an interaction map. Interaction map works in this way. So X will be just some subset of lambda. And to X, you can associate an Hermitian operator that is bounded. So it belongs to the set of bounded operators on this Hilbert space, Hx. Remember what Hx is. It's that guy there. The collection of all the local Hilbert spaces within X. OK. Now, we said, for instance, X can be just 2-body interactions, right? So right now, we have only bounded how many bodies there can be in one interaction. But now we want to say they cannot be arbitrarily far apart. So we define what is called the diameter of X, that is just the maximum distance between any two points in X. So in the case of X being just two points, is the distance between these two points. And we require this to be upper bounded by R. So our interaction map gives us an operator acting on these bodies as long as their their distance, the diameter of this x is smaller than small r, otherwise it's zero. Example, and this will be one of the paramount examples that we'll be studying a lot during this course, the quantizing model. Okay. In the quantizing model, we have a graph that is some set of points, some edges, and these edges will just be links, so just pairs of points. So this means that in X, we don't have more than two points. Okay? And you can associate these types of interactions. For instance, when X is just one point I belonging to my local Hilbert, to lambda, I associate this operator G, J, sigma x at the site I. So in this case, the cardinality of x is 1, so it obeys this bound, right? Or x can be a pair of points belonging to lambda square. In this case, I associate J, let me put a minus here, this operator that acts, so this is an operator in this Hilbert space, right? And this one is an operator in HI tensor HJ. And I have the constraint. Now I have to put the constraint on the range that the maximum distance, the diameter of X, is smaller than R, which means that, so the diameter of X when X is just one point is always zero. And the distance between I and J is whatever I want it to be, R. If R is 1, means that only when they're near a neighbor, they interact. So these are all our interactions. And our Hamiltonian is simply the sum of all the interactions. So in this example, this will be equal to minus gj, the sum of every spin of sigma I x, minus j, the sum over all the edges in my graph of this interaction and I and j cannot be more than r apart. Small r. I guess that every one of you is familiar with the polymatrices, right? I don't need to define them. So do you have some questions now about all this?
Back to the big R, little r local thing. Yeah. Little r is for operators that are in the Hamiltonian, and is big R for any operators that we want to.
So, R says how many Hilbert spaces are involved in each interaction. So, in this model, we have only one body interactions and two body interactions. So, what is capital R?
Two.
Okay. Small r says, what is the maximum distance between any two bodies in an interaction? And this is small r. So say that, for instance, we have only interaction between I and j that are near neighbors. Like in this case. Okay? Because we are summing over all the links. If there is a link, the distance is by definition 1. And so this is a 2-1 local system. Okay? Yeah?
Your definition here have self-interactions then? Because you have the power set, the way you've defined it, you can have II both pulled from lambda squared, right? So, like, your two-point sets can have an object and then the object itself?
Yeah, in principle, you can.
Right.
But in this case, I'm choosing I and j being different because they're the links. Yeah. So I'm choosing graphs. So in principle, you can have edges that have this shape.
Yeah.
So that's a possibility within this description. Yeah. In this example, we do not have that. I and J are different.
Oh, because you said they're links right at the start.
Yeah.
So that you basically can put lower bounds on the diagonal too, in that sense.
Come again?
You can put lower bounds on the diameter then in this formalism. Because you basically put a lower bound on the diameter of
one. If you want, this is the one body interaction, right? That corresponds to that edge that is an edge of itself. But yes, you could. You could define a model in which, you know, it is, when we say R local, we are concerned with the upper bound. Of course, it could be that you only have this term, right? So this is not there. Only you have a term that has three bodies. So, as a matter of fact, you also have a lower bound. But for most of our interests, the lower bound is not very interesting. It's the all the things that we are concerned with typically will involve an upper bound on these ranges and on this locality. But sure, why not? Yeah, you can definitely think of, you know, some lack of locality that comes from the fact that interactions are more than something. So it is a possibility within this description. Okay, so see, now we have the quantumizing model will be the first model that we study. And it will take us a few lectures. This is a very interesting model because despite of being so simple, it does feature all we want to understand about spontaneous symmetry breaking. That is the first object of our attention. And how these things are related to correlation functions and entanglement and all that. So tomorrow we will see why correlation functions give us a first definition of what we mean by a quantum phase. Okay, so that we start understanding that the pattern of correlations gives us a sense of what it means for two different states to be in the same quantum phase or being in different quantum phase. Okay? Good. So we're done for today.